This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal land. Tonight, the United States outlines plans to send more military forces to Australia in the years ahead, citing the threat posed by China in the region. Also, a new call for regulation of the shadow market in human breast milk that experts say is putting babies at risk. And an artificial intelligence text generator is surprising experts with its capabilities, which even includes answering questions about itself.
There are also potential drawbacks that should be considered, such as the possibility of fake news and manipulation.
We should be worried that people are going to weaponize this and use it to generate lots of fake news and phishing SMSs and emails that we're more likely to click on.
Thanks for your company. The United States military will send more forces to Australia in the coming years, with US officials directly referring to the threat posed by China in the region as justification. The statements from US Defence Secretary Lloyd Austin were made alongside his Australian counterpart, Minister Richard Marles, who's in Washington, D.C. for annual talks known as AUSMIN. Secretary Austin says the US and Australia stand united and determined to be a force for stability in the region.
China's dangerous and coercive actions throughout the Indo-Pacific, including around Taiwan, toward the Pacific Island countries, and in the East and South China Seas, threaten regional peace and stability. And based upon today's talks, we will increase rotational presence of US forces in Australia. That includes rotations of bomber task forces, fighters, and future rotations of U.S. Navy and U.S. Army capabilities.
So, what does that arrangement mean for the future security of Australia? Defence correspondent Andrew Green is in our Parliament House studio. Andrew, it seems through these talks a solution is emerging from the deep, if you like, regarding our submarine capability gap. Just remind our listeners what that gap is and tell us how we're now likely to plug it.
Australia has for some time been grappling with this emergence of what many see as a serious submarine capability gap that begins to happen in the late 2030s as our existing conventionally powered fleet of submarines, the Collins class, start to get out of service. Now, they're being extended. There's all sorts of life of type extension programs underway. But as they begin to retire in the late 2030s, there is a gap before Australia's nuclear-powered submarines, whatever they look like, begin appearing and going into service with the Royal Australian Navy. What we've heard today from the US Defence Secretary is a pledge that the United States won't leave Australia with any submarine capability gap. Between the lines, you can read that that is, in one instance, killing off any suggestion that Australia would build a third class of boat, so a so-called Son of Collins, to fill that gap. And it's also suggesting that the US is already looking at options to potentially station its nuclear submarines in Australia and possibly having dual Australian-American crews on board.
So are there any questions regarding that in terms of sovereignty of Australia's military forces? Are we ceding that sovereignty to the US?
Very good question, and one that is rightly being pointed to by critics of further stationing of US military assets here. But inevitably, you will see more of a US presence in Australia. That's the way things have been going for many years now. And Australia itself is keen to have a regular rotation of these British and American nuclear boats through Australia as part of the AUKUS arrangement. And we will be, of course, seeing another East Coast submarine base constructed in the years to come to house Australia's future nuclear fleet.
Australia and the US will also integrate Japan into their joint military activities here. How greatly does that tilt the strategic balance in the region?
This is a big development out of AUKUS. You'll have seen in recent months and years, more and more trilateral activity between Australia, the United States and Japan's self-defence force. There is talk that later this week, when Australian officials fly to Japan, that there will be more joint exercises. But those three nations, in the words of one military analyst, are starting to form a bit of a Pacific NATO. There's a real grouping now that we're seeing quite regularly between Australia, the United States and Japan, and there'll be a lot more to be said about those three nations working together in the weeks ahead.
That's our defence correspondent Andrew Green at Parliament House. There are fears babies are being put at risk by an emerging market for breast milk online targeting desperate mothers. Most of the groups that operate do so with good intentions, but there's also demand from buyers who don't have children. Researchers from Monash University and Deakin University have united in a call for breast milk to become regulated, like blood donations, over concerns it's a growing shadow market. Isabel Musali reports.
During her first pregnancy, Perth resident Naomi had more breast milk than she needed.
Initially, I was throwing out 600, 700 mils a day, which I hated because everybody talks about how it's liquid gold and things.
Then she stumbled across a Facebook group in her area, matching up those in her situation with mothers who wanted help.
For me, because I'm donating, it was a no-brainer. I'd rather it go to another baby than throw it down the sink. And especially when there seem to be parents out there wanting this breast milk, it was quite easy for me to do.
Sometimes it was a one-off donation, and for others it became a regular exchange. But Naomi, who doesn't want us to use her real name, says the group only allows free donations, and it's clear there's plenty of mothers reaching out.
Every time somebody puts up a post, you know, with an offer for milk, you get so many people asking to be considered. There's just not enough supply or things being offered to meet everybody's that is wanting breast milk.
This group is just a small part of what experts describe as a growing market for human breast milk in Australia. Dr. Julian Copland is with Monash University's Bioethics Centre. He points to health campaigns about breastfeeding being better than formula, which puts some parents in a difficult position.
You might have a single father, you might have a gay male couple, you might have a woman who's undergone mastectomy or is having issues with breast milk supply. And in these cases, you might have parents who are very genuinely wanting to do what's best for their children and that have taken the messages about around breast is best to heart, trying to source breast milk through informal online networks or online marketplaces to give what they see as the best option to their child.
He's also found another growing group of demand from people who don't have babies, including bodybuilders, cancer patients who believe it'll help them, and those with fetishes. The problem is, no matter who the breast milk goes to and whether or not it's free, it may not be safe.
So if milk is stored improperly, there's a risk of bacterial contamination. There's the risk of transmitting certain kinds of infectious diseases like hepatitis. And when you're dealing with infants who don't really have a say in the risks that they're being exposed to, this becomes, I think, very ethically worrying.
Together with an academic at Deakin University, he's issued a call to define human milk as tissue, so it's regulated like blood donations. In a published research paper called Liquid Gold on the Black Market, they offer a range of regulation recommendations.
There are a lot of really strong analogies between blood and breast milk, and we already have a kind of system set up for blood where it's procured in certain ways, where it's screened, where the storage is carefully managed, and that we imagine something like this could be a good, valuable model for breast milk.
Beyond the Facebook groups, there are a few official milk banks in Australia. Red Cross Lifeblood works with hospitals to ensure premature babies in their care can get access. And it involves a rigorous screening process. Research fellow Laura Klein says for premature babies, there's clear evidence it's needed.
So we know what when those babies don't have access to their mother's own milk, being able to receive donated breast milk instead of formula has been shown to reduce the risk of some very serious complications, such as necrotizing enterocolitis, which can potentially be fatal. Now, for other cohorts of babies or for other groups of babies, there just hasn't been the research to be able to show whether or not there's a benefit. And so we think that filling this gap in evidence and being able to inform clinical practice in these spaces is a really important, really important priority for our research program.
She says while there's demand for those who fall outside of the current criteria, it may be some time before they expand, and that depends on their research.
Isabel Musali reporting there. This is PM. I'm David Lipson. Ahead, the wildly popular app creating artistic portraits from just a few real photos and artificial intelligence. A lot of fun, but what are people giving up in return? Unemployment may be at historic lows, but not everyone is finding it easy to get a job. And some of those who find casual or temporary employment to help make ends meet still have to keep applying for other work in order to stay on the books of Workforce Australia, which connects potential workers to employers. It's just one of the issues being examined by a parliamentary inquiry into Australia's employment services. And as Angus Randall reports, advocates say the system is making it harder for the long-term unemployed to find work.
Angela Allsop spent 6 years on the unemployment list.
After a while, it really got really frustrating. You know, you just thought that when you started going for a lot of job interviews and all that, you just like start giving up.
2 years ago, she found casual work, but what she does day to day is unpredictable. For the moment, she's working in catering and driving trucks for a demolition company in Hobart, not the usual resume for a 54-year-old.
The main ones I've mainly picked up is traffic control, driving heavy rigid, working with vulnerable people, and I've got all my white cards.
Despite having found casual work, Angela still has to apply for jobs every month to keep active on the Workforce Australia system.
It's all right, but at least I don't have to look for 20. I've only got to look for 4.
The Federal Parliament is conducting a widespread inquiry into Workforce Australia, which connects job seekers to employment organisations. The first part of the system under review is Parents Next, which offers income support to parents of young children. But the impact of Workforce Australia on the long-term unemployed is expected to form part of the scope next year. Simone Casey is a senior policy advisor at the Australian Council of Social Service.
Yeah, look, I think it's important that the government does this review because the model for employment services in the past has been kind of based on a different kind of labour market and also just a different kind of attitude towards people who are unemployed. So it's been based on the idea that people are not really looking for work. But I think everyone has come to the realisation that that's not true.
Around 73% of those who use Workforce Australia have been out of work for over a year. That's more than 400,000 people. Simone Casey says even in a job market facing labour shortages, the long-term unemployed are still facing barriers to work.
Employers are always looking for people with recent work experience. They'll prioritise those on any recruitment process that they have. So that means the people who are long-term unemployed get put at the back of the queue.
Workforce Australia came in to replace the previous Job Active Network in July this year. Kristen O'Connell is a researcher at the Anti-Poverty Centre. She says Workforce Australia has created new barriers to employment.
So whether it's applying for jobs that don't exist, attending training that is demeaning and dehumanising and doesn't help you, or connecting you with an exploitative employer on a wage subsidised program or doing free labour and work for the dole, these things are stopping people having the time and energy to do meaningful job search.
Kristen O'Connell doubts the inquiry into Workforce Australia will end up helping the unemployed. She believes there's action that can be taken now.
It's not hard for government to do the right thing for unemployed people, but we're very useful to them when they get to kick us and blame us for problems that have nothing to do with us. We saw in 2020 that mutual obligations can be suspended and people can be paid above the poverty line overnight.
Labor MP Julian Hill is chairing the inquiry into Workforce Australia. He says the current system is clearly failing both employers and the long-term unemployed. The National Employment Services Association represents private organisations contracted by the government to find work for job seekers. Sally Sinclair is its CEO. She says there's an opportunity to strengthen the system, but defends its work so far.
I think that the sector's been doing a very good job for a very long time. Under the arrangements that have been both the policy and program arrangements of the government of the day.
Submissions close at the end of February next year and a report is due in September.
Angus Randall reporting. New research has revealed an alarming rate of food insecurity across Tasmania. The island state has the lowest average weekly earnings in the country, and as the cost of food rises, so has the number of households going without meals or cutting back on food to get by. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
At this supermarket at Lindisfarne on Hobart's eastern shore, shoppers are changing their habits to combat the rising cost of living.
Sometimes we don't have enough food at home, and so I will have to go without lunch or something.
I suppose you do look for things that are cheaper. I'd say that, yes, I spend about $120 more than I used to pay for things. There's three of us.
A bit more frugal with all the shopping, I think, yeah.
Dr. Catherine Kent is a researcher at the University of Tasmania.
Food insecurity means that all people are able to put enough healthy food on the table every day. And we've been tracking this throughout the COVID pandemic.
The latest report from the Tasmania Project is the result of cost of living surveys undertaken in September and October. It's done by the University of Tasmania, and it's found one in two households experienced food insecurity in the previous month. Dr. Kent says that figure's doubled since May last year. It captures marginal security, where there's a lack of food in the house, low security, where quality and variety is reduced, and very low security, where people are forced to go without.
Really worryingly, the rates of very low food security have tripled. That's where people are regularly skipping meals and going hungry. And the rates of low food security, where people are eating really poor quality foods to cope because they don't have enough money for food, have doubled on last year's figures.
Food insecurity is extremely pronounced amongst young adults, affecting 92% of those aged between 18 and 24. Other at-risk groups are people who are unemployed, temporary residents, single parents, people living with a disability, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander identifying people.
We collected stories from people who are eating less meat and dairy than they'd like to be, that it's cheaper for them to buy donuts rather than apples, that they're borrowing money from their savings to cover their grocery costs, or that they have even resorted to stealing from supermarkets or dumpster diving because they don't have enough money for food.
Carl Saunder is manager of Eat Well Tasmania, a non-government organisation that champions healthy eating. He is gravely concerned about the situation.
Only 1 in 10 of those that need it most are coming forward and actually accessing what we call food relief. So I think part of the problem is we need to understand how the other 90% that need it are currently accessing food and making it available so it's easy for them to get it when they need it.
We need to think innovatively as to how we address that.
Andrew Hillier is chief executive of Loaves and Fishes, which provides food to relief organisations across Tasmania. He says while there's huge unmet demand in the community, food relief charities are already stretched to their limits. That's a challenging problem to solve.
So we've got two issues. One is that obviously we've got to increase our supply, but we also have to work far more creatively on how we actually address the issue of getting food to those who need it.
Mr. Hillier says it's time to think outside the square.
One of the most significant things for us is we're just encouraging people to start really looking out for their mates, finding those around them who perhaps are struggling and helping them.
Researchers have briefed the Tasmanian government on their findings, worried that without intervention, the situation will worsen. The government acknowledges it's concerning and is working on a food security action plan to be released next year.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting there. The world of artificial intelligence made another great leap forward this week with the release of a linguistic tool that can do pretty much anything you ask of it. ChatGPT can write stories, lesson plans, or fake news articles. It can code computer programs, even compose poems. For example, ask it to write a haiku about failure. Here's one response.
In the darkness falls the fallen leaves of failure, but spring will come again.
Not bad. Or how about this request? Write a business letter from Paul to Bob offering to landscape his garden for $2,000.
Dear Bob, I am writing to offer my landscaping services for your garden. I have been in the landscaping business for several years and have a great deal of experience in creating beautiful outdoor spaces.
And on it goes. So, how transformational and disruptive will this type of technology be? Toby Walsh is a professor of artificial intelligence at UNSW in Sydney. So, Toby Walsh, we've just heard a few examples of what this tech can do, from haikus to business letters for a landscaping company. But just how broad is this technology and the application that it can be used for?
It is very broad. We're still trying to discover exactly what it can do. But it can write computer code. It can answer exam questions. A colleague gave a midterm machine learning exam to it, and he got 31 out of the 36 questions right. And indeed found a bug in one of the questions. There's still things, though, that need to be ironed out. It will give you sometimes correct answers, but equally, it's very good at just hallucinating stuff and making it up.
Mm. So how does it actually work?
It's a bit like the autocomplete on your smartphone. When you're tapping away trying to type a word, the autocomplete works out the next letter for you based upon the frequency of letters and in words. And this is like that, but on steroids. They've literally poured the whole of the internet into this system, and it doesn't know just how to complete the next letter. It knows how to complete the sentence and even the whole paragraph.
Wow. So you've been playing around with this technology ahead of this interview in anticipation of what I might ask you, and you asked whether we should be worried or excited about ChatGPT. This was the response.
It is understandable to have mixed feelings about this technology. On one hand, it has the potential to make our lives easier and more efficient by improving natural language processing in chatbots and virtual assistants. On the other hand, there are also potential drawbacks that should be considered, such as the possibility of fake news and manipulation, as well as job loss in industries that rely on natural language generation.
Right, so that sounds like a pretty good answer to me. Toby Walsh, what do you make of it?
It's an excellent answer, in fact. It's a worryingly perfect summary, I think, of the things that we should be worried about. We should be worried that people are going to weaponize this and use it to generate lots of fake news and phishing SMSs and emails that we're more likely to click on, as well as take away certain routine jobs. The people who used to write business letters won't be employed to write business letters if we've got powerful assistants that we can just command to do that. Equally, it could, for most of us, it could remove many mundane tasks. I mean, no one actually ever liked writing a business letter. So the fact that we've got computers to do that, I think, is a good thing.
It's clearly very good at some things, but it falls over pretty badly on some fairly simple tasks too. Can you give us an idea of those sort of traps for this technology?
Yeah, it is very easy to find where it will fall over. I mean, you ask it something simple. You ask it, what is the first letter of the alphabet written backwards? And it will say A. Of course, it's clearly Z. But it will say it with great confidence so that people will believe it. And so I think the difference between what is true and false, which is already somewhat fungible on the internet, will become even more so.
It's evolving, though, isn't it? So we're a few versions into this technology. How much better do you think the next version will be, and the one after that and the one after that?
Well, we know what the next version is going to be. It's called GPT-4. It's the next iteration. And we believe it's going to be another step change. It's an order of magnitude bigger than the current systems we've got. It has something approaching the complexity of the human brain. Wow. And so it's going to be, I think, even more surprising, even more remarkable what it can do.
The complexity of the human brain, that obviously doesn't mean the intelligence, the functionality of a human brain, though, does it?
No, it doesn't. And the other thing is, it works in quite a different way to the human brain. The things it does well are different to the things the human brain does well, and the things it fails on are different to the ones that the human brain. So we can't really come at it with our own human expectations.
Do you think this technology ultimately could be more useful than Google?
Yes, I would imagine. If I owned Google shares, I'd be selling them and buying Microsoft, who have a relationship with OpenAI and have the first rights to use any of this technology.
Right, because Microsoft is the company that has its hands on this tech at the moment. But Elon Musk is very heavily involved as well, isn't he?
Elon Musk is one of the investors in OpenAI. And of course, his ultimate goal is to build AGI, artificial general intelligence, a computer that is smart, if not much smarter than humans.
Wow, what happens to us at that point?
Well, hopefully there are intelligent servants and they do all the dirty, dull, difficult and dangerous things for us, and we can sit back and enjoy the cocktails.
Yeah, lie on the beach and enjoy it. Toby Walsh, great to talk to you. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
Toby Walsh is a professor of artificial intelligence at UNSW. Well, from AI-generated words to portraits and a wildly popular app on social media that can turn a few photos into a portrait in any style you want. But behind all the slick pictures are concerns about privacy, the true origins of the artwork, and how the likenesses are used. Here's Claudia Long.
It's an app topping the charts around the world, creating artwork that appears to be portraits of you in different styles and from different eras. They're like selfies if you happen to be in the 17th century or the 27th. So how does it do it? In part, users are asked to upload a bunch of real headshots, but it also uses something called Stable Diffusion Artificial Intelligence, meaning it's essentially been trained with billions of images from the internet and is mixing them together to create new ones. Artist and lecturer at the Victorian College of the Arts, Kieran Robinson, says while the tech is futuristic, the practice isn't.
In a way, it's nothing new. This is what art's been doing for centuries, whether people are learning by copying other masters' works or artwork they see or things that they see.
On social media, some artists have been voicing their opposition to the app, calling it predatory and saying it steals from creatives while seeking to ultimately replace them. We often hear about AI potentially snatching away our jobs by being more efficient at them. But how does that apply to something as inherently human as art?
The issues that people are worried about is that sort of whether AI is potentially can replace, I guess, illustrators and the work that illustrators do by just mimicking styles. And then that potentially is a real issue for that industry. There is a real commercial, I guess, price that some people will pay, portrait painters. When photography came along, that industry had to alter grossly because photographs did cheaper and more accurate to life portraits.
The use of AI like this raises major questions about who owns the final images and the source material they're made from.
So there's quite a few IP issues in this space, and a lot of them are unresolved.
Suren Dial is an intellectual property expert with the Australian National University. He says right now there's not really much recourse for artists who are concerned that their work is being used to generate profit for apps like Lenser and its parent company, Prisma Labs.
They definitely have ownership in the original work. The question is whether they have any claim of ownership in the AI-generated work. And at the moment, it'd be difficult to contend that.
If you want more than a couple of AI portraits from the app, you'll need to fork out for access to your own likeness, starting at around $4. The company owns the intellectual property for the images created by the app, perpetually and royalty-free. And as for those 10 selfies you might have uploaded, they may not just be used to make cute pics. Catherine Manstead is the Director of Cyber Intelligence and Public Policy at CyberCX.
It's nice to think about art and beautifying your selfies, but there are more nefarious reasons why companies put these apps out, one of which is they're trying to train their artificial intelligence models so they can make more money down the track. And if you look at Lenser's terms of service, they're pretty explicit that they will use your images that you create through the app to improve their services, so to train their AI to make it better.
AI is increasingly used across modern societies, but Catherine says uploading your face to programs like this is a whole different ballgame.
That's a set of really powerful biometric identifiers that will be with you for life, and we should think really carefully before we hand it over. We do know, and there are examples in the past, regardless of where the company is located, that companies with powerful facial recognition models and powerful artificial intelligence models, they'll sell data. They'll sell their data to companies, to governments, to law enforcement.
Intellectual property expert Suren Dial says now is the time for governments to be firming up laws and legislating to protect people when it comes to these technologies.
It really cries out for reform because the courts can't do it. They can't act fast enough. What I'd like to see is kind of a parliament creates, like, it's almost like a new category of IP for AI-generated works, which takes into account what are the rights of the people whose work went into training the AI, the rights of the people who created the AI, the rights of the people who used the AI to create something new.
That's Seren Dial from the Australian National University ending that report from Claudia Long. And that's the program for today. Thanks very much for joining us on PM. I'm David Lipson. Don't forget you can check out ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. While energy giants have made massive excess profits this year worth billions of dollars, consumers are facing soaring power bills. Today, the ABC's energy reporter Dan Mercer and the government's plan to intervene in the market to ease the pain. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.